Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Enjoy a tall, cool dude.
What is this? What are we doing? What in God's name are we doing? Look, our lives. What kind of lives are these? We're like children. We're not men.
No, we're not. We're not men.
It's the Nightcap.
Are we going to be sitting here when we're 60 like two idiots?
We should be having dinner with our sons when we're 60.
We're pathetic. You know that?
Yeah, like I don't know that I'm pathetic.
On WGR, Sports Radio 550.
So then you asked yourselves, isn't there something more to life?
Yes.
Yeah, well, let me clue you in on something.
There isn't.
All right, a little Seinfeld there to bring you into the Nightcap. What's up? Joe DiBiase here for the next couple of hours, hanging out with you on WGR. Some Bills chatter to get to. An interesting thing I heard Therese Paylor of Yahoo say earlier today on the station that I want to bring up. A little fantasy talk. There was a conversation on the afternoon show about vetoing. Get into that a little bit. Preseason games. And just their presence on this earth, I'm ready for that to just be stricken from the record. Get rid of it. And I got a couple of fun, interesting ideas, I think, that could be put forth to get rid of the preseason. The NFL's actually putting a new proposal in, or they're going for one. So I'll bring up what that is, too, in the merits of that idea. And also a word on the Sabres. I said yesterday I wanted to get some hockey talk, and I don't think I ended up getting there until the very end of the show. And there is a clip from Elliot Friedman today on Sportsnet 590, and he mentions the Sabres when talking about still unrestricted free agent defenseman Jake Gardner. And I want to get into that a little bit later. Gardner as an idea, kind of revisit him. He came up in rumors a couple of weeks ago, maybe about a month ago, and that there was a rumor that he might be ready to sign with the team, but they're waiting for stuff to happen. And more I'm starting to think that it's possible that the Sabres are that team. So I'll get into that later, too. But first, Therese Paylor, Yahoo. You maybe just heard him with the guys. If you didn't, it's on demand at WGR550.com. There's one specific thing that Therese said that made me kind of think about that and go, okay. Because we've spent a lot of time thinking about the Bills ceiling and the Bills floor. And of course, we've also spent a lot of time with Allen and what his ceiling could be and what his floor could be. And interesting to hear a guy, a smart guy, from an outside, unbiased point of view and what his thoughts are of Allen, especially a guy, by the way, that likes Allen, what he thinks the ceiling is for this guy. If you missed it, here is what Therese Paylor said on that subject.
Mahomes is a completely different deal. Josh Allen's not Mahomes. He's not going to be Mahomes. That's not reasonable. Mahomes is generational. But I'm telling you, is that same guy who's been pretty consistent on that the whole time, he has Pro Bowl talent. He does. If he continues developing and gets good coaching, he can lead you on a deep playoff run. I believe in that.
So wouldn't it be interesting if Allen doesn't really become the guy that we all expected they were going for when they drafted him? Like, what? Rewind back to last spring and think about when all this time was being spent on each guy, each quarterback, what the talk was about Allen specifically. And you go back to that time, and I think you'll hear that he is the boom or bust prospect. He is the guy with a high ceiling and an incredibly low floor. And it's not all that likely that he's going to fall somewhere in between because of his arm, because of his strengths, and because of what his weaknesses are, his inaccuracies. There's a chance he is amazing, and there's a chance that he is absolutely nothing and just can't figure it out in the league. And after year one, and given some of the stuff that I'm hearing about him and seeing some of the film breakdowns about Allen and seeing what the Bills are trying to do around him, I'm wondering if it's not likely at this point that Allen is kind of what Terese Paylor is saying there. Pro Bowl level quarterback. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, all right, Pro Bowl, like that's what we're talking about. Guys who make the Pro Bowl are what? They're pretty good. But at the end of the day, we're not talking about Tom Brady. We are not talking about Aaron Rodgers. Mahomes went last year, but I doubt he's going to be in the Pro Bowl much more often than that. And like, look who some of the quarterbacks are. Like, Kirk Cousins is in the Pro Bowl a couple of times. Tyrod Taylor is in the Pro Bowl. Matt Schaub is a guy who made the Pro Bowl. Like, Andy Dalton, Pro Bowl. Like, those are the guys we're talking about. Pretty good named quarterbacks, franchise quarterbacks. Even Ryan Tannehill, I think, made one. They're franchise quarterbacks, but you wouldn't call them superstars. So how much is that really worth? Now, on the other hand, Paylor does mention there a guy good enough to make a deep playoff run. Even that. Like, what are we talking about? Joe Flacco was a guy that was good enough to make a deep playoff run. He won a Super Bowl. He got hot. Is he a franchise quarterback? I don't think so. And the team that had him doesn't think so anymore because they shipped him off to Denver and drafted a quarterback they don't even want to throw the ball with. Nick Foles was good enough to have a deep playoff run. Back up around the league a lot of his career. Now he's in Jacksonville. The team moved on from him. So, Pro Bowl, all right. Deep playoff run, all right. But ultimately, this is part of the reason my bar has always been really high for Allen. To me, Pro Bowl, deep playoff run, those are great accomplishments. I think that I would be somewhat happy with a result like that from the development of this kid. This guy, I don't know if I can call him kid. He's not that much younger than me. But that's not what we were looking to draft. We're not looking for the guy that can take part of the team. And if everything around him is great, if the offense around him has talent all over the place, if the coaching staff always knows what they're doing, if the defense is always good, then he's good enough to win. No, I don't want the then. The reason you draft him is because you drafted the guy with the high ceiling. You drafted the guy with the potential that if he makes it work, you can have some holes on your roster. You can have an underwhelming defense. You can have a poor running game. You can have a bad offensive line. And he'll make up for it. That's a true franchise quarterback. That's not Andy Dalton. That's not Kirk Cousins. That's not Nick Foles. And that's not Joe Flacco. Those are all quarterbacks who have either made the playoffs or made deep playoff runs and have made Pro Bowls. To me, that's not good enough for this guy. With that arm, with that skill set, we should be wanting a lot more than that. I think we should be expecting more than that. Because if that doesn't happen, I'm going to want them to move on. If I was a Miami Dolphin fan the last 5 years, I would have been pleading with them to move on from Ryan Tannehill a lot sooner than they did. If I were a Bengal fan, I would be pleading with them right now, move on from Andy Dalton. He is only so good. These are not quarterbacks that, like I said, can make up for other stuff. It's not Aaron Rodgers, where if they have no running backs left and their defense is not that good and their coach is a boob in Mike McCarthy, he's still going to make them a playoff team. He's still going to make them really good. The Texans with Deshaun Watson, if they're got a bunch of injuries at wide receiver, Will Fuller, Kiki Kuti, like two of their best receivers, always hurt. Not much of a running game behind Lamar Miller. A very bad offensive line. Guess what? Deshaun Watson is special. Deshaun Watson is good enough to overcome all of those things and make that a playoff team. Russell Wilson in Seattle. The offensive line, just like with Watson, dreadful, just terrible. Not a great running game. Has not had a great running back since Marshawn Lynch. The defense isn't as good as it used to be. Russell Wilson, he is special. That team, still right there, playoff team almost every year. That's what we need out of Josh Allen. That's what the bar should be. Because if you don't meet that bar, I don't know if I want to hang on to you long term. So I think that needs to be the goal. That needs to be the expectation. And even though I think what Terrez Paylor is saying here is meant as a compliment, hey, this is a guy that has Pro Bowl talent. Like that, you would think that's a compliment. It is. But to me, at the end of the day, I think you still want a little bit better than that. You still want to have a quarterback that you can trust and not have down years like a lot of those guys I mentioned have had. You can trust him to be consistent in his production. Maybe not week to week, but year to year. You can be a guy that is consistently considered in the MVP conversation. Like, ultimately, wouldn't you want that? He might never win it. He might never win it. But think about like what Cam Newton is. Think about what like Matt Ryan even are. Like maybe that would be the minimum I would want for Allen. He needs to be a guy that, at the very least, is capable of winning like an MVP trophy once. Because there are quarterbacks around the league that are in it every year. I understand that. Like Rodgers and Mahomes and Andrew Luck. Like when those guys are all healthy, they are in the MVP conversation. Then there are quarterbacks who, you know, they play 10 years, they're pretty good, and they'll have a year or two where they are in that conversation. Matt Ryan had that one amazing year where he won MVP. Cam Newton had that one amazing year where they made the Super Bowl and he won MVP. Matthew Stafford, he didn't win the MVP, but he had that one amazing year earlier in his career where he threw for over 5,000 yards and he was throwing the ball all over to Calvin Johnson. I'm sure that was a part of it, but Matthew Stafford was capable of putting that one tremendous season together. Does Allen have that? Does Allen have that in him? That is something above that other tier of quarterbacks I was talking about before. That's something better than that. And I really think not just for the Bills' sake, but for the division's sake, if we want to be in this conversation long term, what should the expectation be for Allen? Part of it is what I just said. The other part of it is you got to be better than Sam Darnold, and you got to be better than Josh Rosen. Now, the latter one there with Rosen, I think you might not be too worried about that right now. I don't think you would have reason to be too worried about that right now. But after Brady's done, whenever that inevitably ends up being, could be after this year, could be 4 years from now, who knows? Who takes over the division? Or do you have a struggle? Do you have a back and forth? Like, I think about the AFC North for this, year after year after year. Like, imagine what it's like to be even like a Ravens fan or a Bengals fan. For a decade, you go into the year and who knows, the division could be anybody's. Now, this team might be favored, this team might be favored, but you really know at the end of the day, three teams could win the division. And we have not lived in a reality like that in how long? At the very least, he needs to be good enough where he matches, if not exceeds, what Sam Darnold becomes with the Jets. And me personally, I like Darnold a little bit more than Allen. I've said that repeatedly. I like Darnold a lot as a quarterback. That's not to say I don't like Allen. I really like Allen at this point as well. But I think Darnold's going to be a really good quarterback. To what extent? Maybe he doesn't become as good as, you know, the Cam Newtons and the Matt Ryans. Maybe he is in that third tier with the Daltons and the Tannehills and the Flaccos. Like the placeholder franchise quarterback is really what that is. That's all I'm saying. All I'm saying is I want the expectation to be a little bit higher than that. And that's better than, you know, Trubisky last year with the Bears. That's better than Jameis Winston with the Buccaneers. Better than Marcus Mariota with the Tennessee Titans. Dak Prescott with the Cowboys. Now, it depends on what you think of Dak Prescott, but I think he's kind of in that territory. Where does Allen ultimately land? And the reason I'd be optimistic that he is capable of exceeding that bar, that just Pro Bowl level good bar, is because of his arm, because of his athleticism, and I would even say because of the seemingly big step he's taken in his development. I thought a big factor in what he might look like this year. If you watch Dan Orlovsky's video on social media, or if you missed him, he was on our station yesterday talking about Allen. The pre-snap process, the knowing when to utilize certain weapons, knowing when to pick up blitzes, knowing when to actually run at, or scramble as opposed to taking your check down, all of that put together. I think there's a lot of reason to believe right now that Allen's going to be better in those areas than we maybe once thought. Now, the one thing I'm still will never, unless he does it, I'm not going to assume he's going to get better at it, is his accuracy. But if everything else is going well, then he could be the guy that ultimately becomes a very good quarterback despite not having the accuracy. But that's if he gets almost everything else right. We know he's got the arm strength. We know he's got the athleticism. Does he get the pre-snap process right? Will that actually translate to the regular season? Will he know when to throw it to Cole Beasley? Will he know game situations and when that's a smart idea? Will he know when to take a shot? Will he know when to know if John Brown's coming open over the middle or on a deep post? Like, will he know how to see those things? And I think a lot of that, there is reason to be optimistic about him right now, which is why that's where I ultimately have landed with him. Yes, my bar is very high for him, but I think that that should be the case with all Bills fans. And I also think that that's not meant to be a criticism. I think there's reason to be optimistic he can meet a high bar even like that. But it should exist not just because of what we should want out of a quarterback. It should exist because of who they drafted. This would be an entirely different conversation for me if they had drafted Josh Rosen. Entirely different. That guy needs some other stuff around him. I think he's good. I think if in the right situation, I actually really like Josh Rosen. I wanted the Bills to draft him. Looking back, a little happy they didn't do that, to be fair. I would definitely admit that I was wrong at this point on that, for sure. I don't think you know how you would begin to argue the other side of it. But if we wanted the quarterback that's only a certain amount of good and the wanted the quarterback where you don't really have that extra layer that you could expect out of him, then you would have drafted Josh Rosen or even Lamar Jackson. Because I think I'd want to say Josh Allen's ceiling's a lot higher than Lamar Jackson, not just because he was drafted so much higher, but it's because of his arm. Jackson just doesn't have it. He, I think, is a better passer than he gets credit for, but you wouldn't think he has the same capability of Allen in that respect at all. Allen's the guy that you drafted because, hey, maybe we would have rather had Mayfield, maybe we would have rather had Darnold. I think they would have rather had Darnold. But Allen's the guy that even if you think it's not as likely that he's as good as Mayfield and Darnold, you know he's got the capability to do it. That's why you drafted him. He might never be Mahomes, like Tavares Paylor says. I would be floored if he became that good. Because, like Tavares Paylor said, Mahomes is a generational player. And I don't see that for Allen. But to completely dismiss it might also be wrong because of all that he presents as a player. And the other good news, I think, on it, listening to a lot of these smart guys, Steve Palazzolo yesterday, Dan Orlovsky yesterday, Tavares Paylor today, I think another big reason I'm optimistic, and I think a lot of Bills fans are so quick to defend him and so quick to come to his defense, is the stuff he needs to work on is the simple stuff. Like, why did a lot of Bills fans, I didn't do it, I was always defending him, but why did a lot of Bills fans get on Tyrod Taylor's case? Because he didn't make the throws they really wanted him to make. He never took the chances. For me, part of that was he just didn't possess that capability, and he was an intelligent enough quarterback to know that he wasn't good enough to do that. But that is why you ultimately moved on from him. Whereas Allen, you'll come to his defense, and I think a lot of Bills fans will automatically do it, because they see him trying to make throws like that. They see a guy that he's got the whole playbook in front of him. He's got every throw in front of him. It's all available at any moment. Anything you want to do is available because of who your quarterback is. And the questions are the simpler ones. It's, can you check it down? Can you take the safe stuff? Can you know when to slide? Can you know when to scramble versus take a chance? All that stuff should be the simple stuff, and all of that stuff is a lot easier to defend than I know it. I tried to defend Tyrod Taylor as much as possible. You could only go so far because you knew that there was a cap. You knew there was only so good he could be. And I think we've yet to really explore and find out how good Allen can be. And I think this year, I bet you I make my judgment on what he is after this season. Because I'm a believer that good to great young quarterbacks, they'll show it, if not in their rookie year, in their second year. You will see it pretty much right away. It is an extreme rarity that a guy will show struggles in his first couple of years and then figure it out later. Like, this is why I got right away with on the Mariota stuff. So I have a couple of friends who were like big, big Mariota fans when he was coming out of college. I remember that draft, having discussions with them. They were big Mariota guys. And after watching him his rookie year and then a little bit into his second year, I just was looking at him and watching him play every week, and I'm just like, I just don't see it. I don't see how this guy becomes a great quarterback. He can be good. He can be Alex Smith. I just don't see the pathway to being great. And I will say for Allen, while I'm not sold it's going to happen, that path is sitting there. He's just got to go down it. It's a nightcap with Joe DiBiase. 803-0550 is the phone number. Like I said, I want to get into a little hockey later, and I do want to bring up a couple of interesting proposals to help, if not eliminate the preseason. That's probably a tough one, a tough result to get to. Ways to limit it, draw back a little bit from it, 3 games, 2 games, and stuff that the NFL can do to kind of make it even more interesting if they're going to keep it around. I got a couple ideas on that front, little fantasy talk, little Sabres talk. 803-0550 is the phone number. It's the Nightcap with Joe DiBiase here on WGR.
Remember, he's just a kid. So with time, this structure, playing within the structure, it'll come to him. But if the Bills just kind of let him be and let him create and slowly develop, this guy's going to be a good – he has Pro Bowl talent. And I just think people were in such a rush to kind of kill the guy. It was easy to just kind of miss. Like last year when he played, he was doing stuff.
That is Therese Paylor. You know, all of this discussion I had in the last half hour, thinking about Allen and like, would you be okay with him just being Pro Bowl good? Not like a superstar, not, you know, an elite quarterback, not always in the MVP conversation, not even in the discussion for like best quarterback in the league ever, but Pro Bowl. And it's reminding me a lot of my thoughts on what's going on in Dallas right now. So what is so funny is Dallas signs Jalen Smith, the linebacker, yesterday to a long-term extension. And you have to wonder if they only did that to kind of mess with all the other guys' heads. Elliott, Prescott. Hey, we're going to sign the guy. Jerry Jones said it himself. We're going to sign the guy that has never complained, never missed a workout, blah, 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 blah. And whether they should pay their quarterback, who is good, but is he great? Is he amazing? Because I would say no to those questions. I think Prescott has been heavily assisted throughout his career with how good his offensive line has been, with how good the running back is behind him, and I don't know. I think if you picked up Dak Prescott and you put him on the Bills last season, I'm not so sure he'd look better than Josh Allen looked. Like, what does Prescott look like when he doesn't have all of that help around him? And to me, that's what really differentiates a good quarterback from like a special quarterback. To me, a special quarterback can lift up what's around him if it's all not perfect and still be a good team, and he can drive that. Whereas the good quarterback is just good, you know, he can take part if everything around him is nice and everything around him is good, then you can win. But if you've got any holes, if you don't have a good receiver, if you don't have a good O-line, if you don't have a good run game, if you don't have a good defense, well then, now we're suddenly not talking about a great team. And I think we're going to find out this season, and if not this season, the next year, year and a half, whether Allen is just a good quarterback. I guess there's still a chance he could flame out. I don't know if I could see that happening after him being somewhat good last year, but I guess it could happen. But we're still trying to find out if he's going to be good or special. And I think the bar should be special. 803-0550 is the phone number. We're going to hear from Marcel Louis Jacques in a few minutes from ESPN. Let's go to Jonathan. Jonathan, what's up, man? You're on the Nightcap.
Hey, Joe. This is an interesting subject because I'm glad you have high expectations, because I think the last 20 years of Bills football have low expectations. But what if I came from the future and said, this year the Bills will be 15-1, Allen's going to be voted league MVP, and they will lose the Super Bowl. And then next year will be 6-10. That's Cam Newton and the Carolina Panthers. A lot of experts have compared Allen to Newton. Would you be okay with a Cam Newton and the scenario I just laid out?
See, to me, thanks for the call, man. And I think you're right, by the way. I think that, and I think it's fair, but the last 20 years have lowered our quarterback expectations. I think that's fair. Like, I think it's fair not only that it's right, but I think it's fair that that's how a lot of Bills fans think. But would I take Cam Newton for Josh Allen? I think I'd have to say yes to that, but that is the bare minimum I would take. Because, and that might change depending on what you think of Cam Newton. I don't think of him as, he is special in a way. He's more unique than he's special. I don't think he's a special quarterback. I think he had one special season, and I don't want to say, I think he's unique. That's what I would call him. And, you know, Allen is that. But you've seen it out of Cam. When the team around him isn't set up to be great, like everything around him was great that Super Bowl year. When that doesn't happen, he's only so good. He'll have a bunch of losing seasons. He's had four losing seasons, five actually, and three winning seasons. He's had how many years? Every year but two, he's had below a 60% completion percentage. He hasn't thrown for over 25 touchdowns. He's actually only thrown for over 25 touchdowns once. Remember yesterday, Steve Palazzolo said, like, I could see Allen having a year or two where he throws for 28 touchdowns. And I think maybe I thought of that and thought, 28 touchdowns? Like, what? That needs to be better. We need to be better than that. He needs to be consistently throwing 28 touchdowns. Cam Newton doesn't do that. Cam Newton throws 21, 19, 24, 18, 19, 22, 24. He had the 135 year mixed in there. But what I will say, Cam will give you a few rushing touchdowns, and that's a bonus. That counts. Cam has 58 rushing touchdowns throughout his career. Can Allen do that? Can Allen average you 5-6 rushing touchdowns a year? Because then, like I said, we're talking about a unique guy who is on the border of being like a legitimate elite franchise quarterback, but maybe not quite there. And I think I would take that. I would sign up for that today, but no less. No less. Because do I want to be... And it's funny you bring up Newton, because it's the Panthers. It's always the team that we're compared to, right? Do I want to be the Carolina Panthers? Because they've been trying to be the Carolina Panthers, it seems. Do I want to be them, legitimately? Because I think I would want to shoot for better than that. That's three losing seasons in the last 5 years. That's one amazing year, followed by really a lot of mediocre sandwiched around it. And is that what I'm trying to be? I'm not trying to be, you know, one amazing year, which would be super fun, I admit it. But then the rest, you know, it's kind of a crapshoot whether I'm going to be good or not. I think the idea of having, or of spending all the assets they spent to try to get so much better at the quarterback position, is that year in and year out, you're in it. And that doesn't necessarily always happen with Newton and the Panthers. 6-8, 6-8. 5-8-1, 7-9, 6-10. Those are all seasons on Cam Newton's resume as the Panthers starting quarterback win-loss style. I don't really like to compare or judge a quarterback too much on his win-loss record, but I think that in this case is representative of what he is as a quarterback. Like, those are the years where not everything's perfect around him. And I like that the Bills have made everything around Allen a lot better. And I hope everything's perfect around Allen, obviously, because they would be, even if Allen's not amazing, they'd be one of the better teams in the league. But ultimately, I want Allen to be good enough where everything doesn't have to be perfect around him. 803-0550 is the phone number. Thanks for the call. We'll get to Marcel Louis Jacques break a little early here. We'll get to that after the break. It's the Nightcap with Jody Biasi here on WGR. All right, welcome back to the Nightcap. Jody Biasi here on WGR. Got some fantasy talk on the way, some Sabres. A little preseason proposal for you. Before that, though, I want to kind of wrap our discussion on the Bills tonight and kind of you know, looking forward to Friday night's game against Detroit, the third preseason game, the all-important, most important preseason game, right? The third one. It's most important by comparison, but, you know, teams are catching on. The Colts, they're not even playing anybody for good reason. They're looking at their starting quarterback on the bench right now. Like, why do we need to risk anybody else? We already are going to be shorthanded. We don't need to be more. Who cares? It's a preseason game. It will not affect how good you're going to be this season. If Luck's healthy week one, I have the Colts in the Super Bowl. For me, that has no impact. What their preseason schedule and results have no impact on that for me. So, little Bills talk here. Marcel Louis-Jacques, the new ESPN Bills reporter, who's been on our station a bunch of times in the past couple of weeks. Some really good content from him. And he joined Steve Tasker and John Murphy earlier today. So we'll play a little of that here. Some thoughts on what's been happening with the Bills, the offensive line, the tight end battle, by the way, which is heating up a little bit now that people are getting healthy again. That and more with Marcel Louis-Jacques earlier today on One Bills Live.
Joining us right now, also on the edge of his seat, happy to talk to the ESPN NFL Nation reporter for the Buffalo Bills. We talked to him in training camp. Happy to have him back, Marcel Louis-Jacques. Hello, Marcel. Thanks for coming by.
Hey, thanks for having me, as always, man. Love to be in the studio with y'all.
We appreciate you coming in.
We're glad you're here. You've been around, in and around training camp. We had John during training camp as well, and at the time we had John, I think Mitch Morse was injured. He still is. What are your thoughts on the offensive line coming into this game? Are you thumbs up, thumbs down, or kind of somewhere in the middle?
Well, I think they were in a position of concern a couple weeks ago when they're seemingly just dropping like flies. You know, Long's missing time. Feliciano is missing time. Morse is out. Waddle goes on IR. And Secchi is in and out of practice. But I think they're finally starting to find some health and some continuity. Mitch Morse entering stage 5 of concussion protocol is an excellent sign. I mean, if you're a Bills fan, that's what you've been more or less waiting for the past 2-3 weeks. But I think that the panic button, you can slowly start to back away from it a little bit. They're looking like that top 5 is going to be ready for week 1 at New York Jets or at the Jets. It looks like they've got some depth in Feliciano. They've got some depth in Long. Still trying to really cement who that swing tackle is going to be. But offensive line problems are not as dire as they were a few weeks ago.
Who is your top 5?
My top 5. In order, starting at left tackle, we got Deion Dawkins, Quinn Spain, Mitch Morse, Cody Ford, Ty Secchi.
That's my top 5. Yesterday.
That's what they're going to run with when everybody is healthy and ready, you know, and active, I could imagine. That's just the most talented lineman that you have on roster right now. And that includes Ford at guard, not tackle.
Right, that's the thing. Insecki's a better tackle than Feliciano or Long at guard, right? Because that's the idea, right?
Yeah, and Ford is just a better guard than he is tackle. Mm-hmm. I mean, that position flexibility is so key for him. And that was such a plus for him entering the draft. That's why a lot of people pegged him as a first-round pick. But I think his strength right now is at right guard instead of tackle, but that's not to say he can't play it.
Right.
Marcel, one thing, and it's a bit of a, you know, blue sky, rose-colored glasses thing that we've heard from McDermott now for about a week, but it's correct. They have developed some versatility by virtue of these injuries they've had. Do you agree?
They do, and it's just the NFL is a league of opportunity here, and injuries happen all the time. And that's when you're going to see guys step up into positions that they might not be comfortable with, they might not be accustomed to, but that's how you learn. I'm a firm believer that the best way to learn is through immersion. So force guys into the first team, force guys at tackle, force guys at center who have never played center before in Ryan Bates, and let them learn and let them react to adversity because – it's not going to be sunshine and rainbows come Sundays.
So, yeah, okay, before the third preseason games and you're sitting here and you've seen all these offensive line, you know, moves and switches and adjustments and adaptations. Have they done enough? Have they got enough guys?
I think you can never have enough offensive linemen. That's the physicality that comes with the position. Injuries are just going to be more common there on the line. But I think it's a strong enough top 5, especially compared to what last season's featured. I think the flexibility and depth that Long and Feliciano add is promising. I think getting McDermott back would be promising, Teller as well. Time will tell. Time will tell. But for right now, I think, like I said before, we can start to, you know, take our hands away from that big red button on the desk that says panic on it, and look forward to a pretty healthy week one.
Offensive line question I have for you, Marcel, is what about cohesion? What about communication up front? They're never going to get a chance to do that when it doesn't count.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting that McDermott said today, Morse has been around the league long enough that preseason's important, but you would think, okay, it's not the end of the world if he doesn't get into a game these four preseason games. But McDermott said no, he needs the reps just like he himself needed reps, that adjusting to a new scheme, a new team, new guys on either side of you, that takes time. You don't want to have to learn that on the fly, especially during a what we'll call it 5-6 game stretch to start the season, where you can get off to an excellent start if you're Buffalo. I mean, you can set the tone for the entire year. You can't afford to lose games because of a lack of cohesion on the offensive line. And so I see the importance in that. I still wouldn't expect Morse to get any preseason action beyond maybe one single series, if that even, though. It's just the risk kind of outweighs the reward.
What do you think about the Josh Allen, the preseason he's put together? I mean, this is an offense that really, in Carolina, they didn't have Luke Kuechly on the other side of the football. And nobody's playing their starters. The Bills are getting some reps with Josh Allen, some ones, and finally did that in Carolina and had a good week leading up to that during the practices. What are your thoughts on Josh Allen's preseason? Has success been too easy?
I mean, it's really hard to fault a guy for doing what he's asked to do. And when you're not playing, when you're playing against a Carolina defense without Kuechly, without Shaq Thompson, I mean, that's what you expect to do. And I think that's a positive sign in its own right, that when you're facing, we'll call it inferior, for lack of a better word, inferior competition, you have to be able to execute. And from what I think we all saw, he executed his game plan just like he needed to. He pushed the ball downfield when necessary. We saw the couple completions to Tommy Sweeney. He took his checkdowns. We saw him just really force feed almost Cole Beasley. But, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I can't fault him for taking these checkdowns because it's just the safe option. It's the smart option. And his job, I think we talked about this last time I was on the show, his job is not to be the hero or the savior of this team. The strength of the Buffalo Bills does not lie in Josh Allen's right arm, no matter how strong it is. All he needs to do is not mess up. In year two, you're kind of a, enhanced game manager here. They don't need him to go out and push the ball downfield in order to win games. They just need him to be efficient with the ball. They need him to score points when need be and let the defense do the rest.
We're on the line with ESPN's Marcel Louis-Jacques. He is the ESPN NFL Nation reporter covering the Buffalo Bills. And Marcel, you wrote about Bills' first-round draft pick, Ed Oliver. About him, what do you think? How's he doing after two games? And how does he think he's doing after two games?
Yeah, he's just got this. I spoke with Shaq Lawson, who said that he's just got this confidence about him that's not normal for a first year player.
Not cocky, is he?
It's not cocky. And I think that was something I really wanted to focus on in the article, that this isn't some sort of rookie bravado where you're a first rounder and you need to show that, I'm big and bad, I'm worth the $10 million a year. He just wants to, he's very aware of what he can do when he's on the field. And I think that shows, and that's shown in the first two games.
I love the fact that in the face of Cam Newton's, constant chatter last week in practice, Ed Oliver, the most he could do is just glare at him, stare him down. I love that.
Yeah, I must have watched that video 60 times. And I'm not going to lie to y'all here. But that's Cam being Cam. First of all, we shouldn't look too far into it. I know I tweeted a lot about it, but it was not serious. That is,
oh, yeah,
that's just
Cam,
how
right?
Cam, he likes to, poke the bear a little bit. But I think it kind of spoke volumes as to who Oliver is as a person to, turn back. I think we're saying it here. To turn back and face him, just to hear Cam out, give him a chance to say, "Hey, are you gonna say anything directly to me, or is this the case where your mom's talking about you to her friends in the living room, and you just kind of have to wear it?"
Right.
But he didn't say anything. Just kind of shook his head and went back to work. And that's what Ed Oliver does. That's who he is. He's not about that trash talk when it comes to opponents. He might jaw back and forth with his teammates, as Shaq said, and as Ed himself admit. But, I mean, you see him right here. It's just like, okay, I hear what you're saying. That's fine. You're a little bigger than I thought, but talk your stuff.
I like that reaction. Yeah,
is there anything to be made, and not for nothing, but Ed Oliver, and this coaching staff has never given any of these players anything. When they earn it, they get it. Ed Oliver went from being a two to a one really fast ahead of Jordan Phillips. And Jordan Phillips is a very good player. Does it say anything about what they – What does it say about that? I mean, do you think he earned it, or do you think they were saying, okay, he's playing good enough, let's stick him in there?
I think you've seen it, or we've seen it, ever since the pads went on, I think the third day of training camp, where he's exactly what they drafted him to be. He's a disruptor, and that, you know, in the interior defensive line. And, I mean, that's what they need. That was the weak point of this defense, was getting after the quarterback. 26th in sacks, that's not an elite trait for what should be an elite defense. And so what they need him to do is exactly what he's doing: wreak havoc, force double teams, open things up a little bit for Jerry Hughes, for Trent Murphy and Shaq Lawson. And, you know, this is the NFL. You're not just going to be thrust into a lineup if you don't earn it, and especially with a guy like Sean McDermott. I don't think that it should be taken lightly that he's running with the ones this early in his career.
Marshall, I mentioned to Steve an hour ago about the Buffalo defense, two preseason games in, how impressed I was with the depth they have developed. You know what I mean? They were number two defense last year. They were pretty good. But now they got backups who seem to play well. And, again, I know who they're going against, but I'm encouraged about the way the backup defenders have played through two games.
And this goes back to what I'm saying before, what I said before about Josh Allen and not undermining his success, that you cannot – You can't knock a guy for doing what he's expected to do. You know, like, if you're a four-string guy and you're going against four-stringers and you're still finding success, like, that's a positive. That it's hard to just, you know, write that off and say, oh, it's a four-string. He's a four-stringer too. This is equal competition for him, and he's showing that he can excel. And when I'm saying that, I'm thinking specifically of Daryl Johnson, who's
okay.
He's just done nothing but make plays whenever he gets the opportunity. We saw a sack and a deflection in week one. I believe we saw another sack and
forced fumble.
In week two. And for a guy that, you know, a seventh round pick, and Leslie Frazier shed a little light on that yesterday. This is a premium position. It's one of, we'll call it, four or five positions where, you know, people will trade up, they'll mortgage a future to go get an elite pass rusher. And so you don't see a lot of high impact guys fall and slip through the cracks. Daryl Johnson might be one of them, and I think if he does pan out, especially with, you know, a little bit of uncertainty opposite of Jerry Hughes, I think this could be a really valuable steal for Buffalo. Like I said, though, if he pans out and the success translates to the regular season.
One of the guys I wanted to ask you about, we started out talking about Josh Allen, and you're right, you can't get on the guy for doing what he's asked to do. Cole Beasley's been asked to get open underneath. Now, they were playing, I would think, Cole Beasley in the game against Carolina, where he had five targets, five catches. We've all heard about it. And even Josh Allen is saying, you know, people are saying, well, it was too easy for him. Well, that's Cole Beasley's job, right? And I mean, do you think Cole Beasley is going to be as big of an effect throughout the season as he was in the Carolina game?
I would expect him to be. He's a mismatch, and Carolina often they're trying to defend him with a linebacker, and that's just not going to work against a guy like Beasley, who is not trying to blow by you. He's trying to shake you free. And what I really loved, he had a completion against, I believe it was Jermaine Carter, on one of those first two drives, where he immediately breaks himself open, and as soon as he can tell that he's got space, he angles that route upfield, and he wants to maximize as many yards as he can possibly get with every target. And I think having that kind of safety net, that's like an incentive for Josh Allen to continue to adjust mentally, you know, his habits, his reads, his progressions. You know, that's an incentive to start looking at your checkdowns and start playing it safe. If you've got a guy who, you know, this guy's going to do whatever it takes to get 6-7 yards anytime he touches the ball, then, yeah, here's the ball.
All right, we'll hear a little more from Marcel Louis Jacques after the break at the top of the hour. It's the Nightcap with Jody Biasi. 803-0550 if you want to get in before we get back to him, though, here on WGR.
Helping you unwind after a long day of work.
I think he's kind of a boob.
Ken really taking the day off as a person. can't go out there and be a moron. It doesn't work like that.
The Nightcap.
Reaping their fruit.
On WGR Sports Radio 550.
All right, welcome back to the Nightcap. Joe DiBiase here on WGR. We're going to get to a little hockey talk, a little fantasy talk in just a little bit. Want to put a wrap on our Bills discussion for the night, though, and our Bills talk for the night. And we'll continue on with Marcel Louis-Jacques, who, by the way, is the new guy at ESPN, if you're not familiar with him. Some good content he's putting out there on the Bills. Here is the remainder of his talk with John Murphy and Steve Tasker earlier today on One Bills Live right here on WGR.
The Bills did not have that dimension in their passing game last year, and now they seem to have it with Cole Beasley. And now they seem to want to use it, which is important too. And I don't think they want to take the deep pass out of the offense either, right? No, I haven't seen a lot of it in two preseason games. But.
No, and because I think that deep ball is more of a situational tool than it should be, I guess, your offense. Exactly.
Yeah.
It shouldn't
be
the focal point of your offense. It's one of the least efficient plays in football.
Right.
That's like in basketball, you know, basing your offense around a half-court shot. Like, looks
right.
great,
that's
but
right.
come on.
I thought you were going to say three-pointers. Teams do base it on three-pointers now.
Yeah, they do
not
now.
A half-court shot. But he's right. It's a half-court shot. It's basically what it is.
Yeah,
exactly. It's not as automatic as Steph makes a three-pointer, makes threes look. But like I say, it's a tool, and that's why they add a guy like John Brown who can stretch that field, because when defenses start to suck in, you know, when Allen's hitting Beasley across the middle repeatedly, and you know, in a perfect world for them, that run game is still, you know, it's still a force to be respected. It might not be dominant, but defenses would have to respect it. Safeties are going to start to creep up, and that's when you try to take the top off.
Is that can you foresee kind of the typical slot receiver that we've seen before? A guy like Cole Beasley who comes out with 110 catches and has 950 yards. You know what I'm saying? An 8 or 9 yard per completion kind of thing, like clockwork, and that's kind of be his thing.
It's not completely out of the question. I think his career high is 75 catches in a season,
right?
And that was in an offense that, by his words, didn't value him, didn't use him correctly. I think Buffalo's going to be pretty pass heavy this season. It's not out of the question that he sees triple-digit targets.
Right.
Whether he hits that 1,000-yard plateau or whether he, you know, even breaks that 100-catch barrier is yet to be seen. That's those are very gaudy numbers to project,
right,
without, you know, this early in the
sure.
process. But I think he could end up being one of those guys whose value is underappreciated. One of those guys, like how I hate to compare, you know, a proven pro to a college player, but right. kind of like how Hunter Renfrow was at Clemson, who, you know, he's not putting up the crazy numbers, but he's consistently moving the chains. He's a consistent option. And he's a reliable option. I think Cole Beasley's career catch percentage is somewhere around 75%. That's, like I said, that's just reliable.
Talking with Bills reporter Marcel Louis-Jacques of ESPN, I've been asking this question or a version of this question since day two of the draft back in April. Do you have any sense of where they're going with the running back group? And not just this Friday, but as they approach cutdown day and the start of the regular season. What do you think?
I think the top three is pretty solidified. I think McCoy, Gore, and Singletary are locks. Like you can
keep all three?
Keep all three. You can quote me on that if you want.
Use all three?
I think you use all three.
How do you do that?
LeSean gets the first. Will probably get the first crack. I think he and Gore will more or less split carries, doing the same role. But Devin Singletary is kind of in his own category. They're using him like Tariq Cohen, like a Darren Sproles. Like I think LA uses Austin Ekeler as well as almost a hybrid slot receiver and running back. You're going to see him in motion a lot. You're going to see him running wheel routes. You're going to see him taking jet sweeps, and I think he can be a very valuable gadget player. I don't know if he's a three-down back. I don't know if he's a feature back. But you don't really have to be you don't have to be in today's NFL. You can be a very valuable and productive running back in that exact role. And if he grows in that, then he's somebody to definitely watch. Obviously, after that, that's when after those three, it gets a little hairy.
Right.
You know, obviously, they signed T.J. Yeldon. He's a proven NFL running back.
Yep.
He's proven he can come in case of injury and be productive. But his lack of experience on special teams, I think, might hurt him here. In that case, I would put probably Sonoris Perry over him. I like what I've seen out of Marcus Murphy as well as a runner. I think he's lightning quick. I think he hits his holes very hard. He just like Beasley, he tries to maximize how much how many yards he gets every time he touches the ball. It's just that his skill set may be a little bit redundant with Devin Singletary in that top three.
Unless he can do all of that and play special teams as well. And because you're right, the top three guys are going to get 95% of the carries, maybe, and DeMarco gets one carry for the season, you know, as at a fullback, you know. And I think, do you think they're just going to, and here's why I think it's going to go, LeSean and Frank Gore are going to, whoever's having the good bets day gets on the field. And they'll give LeSean the first crack. And if he keeps going well, Frank will spell him and then come off the field. And LeSean's right back out there. And just the opposite, if it's one of those days where Frank Gore has to get the tough yards after contact.
I agree. I think LeSean is still, even at this stage of his career, I think he's more of a home run hitter than Frank Gore. Gore's looked as spry as ever for how long he's been in the league. He doesn't look like he's lost a whole lot. But I think he's a powerful between the tackles runner. He's a consistent, you know what you're going to get with him. And you need to chew clock. You need to eat some yards up. Then you're gonna hammer it away with Frank Gore. And I think that makes sense. The hot hand approach makes sense.
Exactly.
That's usually how it goes when you have a committee, and this is looking a lot like a committee.
A week from tomorrow, preseason game number four could be Christian Wade Day here in Orchard Park, right? I mean, why not play him in the fourth preseason?
Why not? I think he'll probably get a little more. He might get a little more action now in game three, but he's been, just electric anytime he touches the ball. But my Lord. We need to calm down the way to the 53 talk. I think he's it's easy to get wrapped up in the shiny new thing. And right now, Christian Wade is the new toy on this offense. But let's be very realistic here. He's made two plays and he's only gotten the ball four times. I haven't been doing this NFL thing a long time, but I learned quickly. And one thing I've learned is that the people who are around the team every day usually know more than the fans, than even the media. They're seeing them practice. And the people who make the decisions here have decided Christian Wade's the last running back to touch the ball these past two games.
Right.
There's probably a reason for that. He is every bit a high-caliber athlete. I think he's an NFL-caliber athlete, no doubt. But you've seen a couple times where his rugby instincts kick in before his football instincts kick in. You saw it in that opening handoff. I mean, rugby Twitter, correct me if I'm wrong, but
he took the handoff wrong.
Yeah, he took it like he's taking a rugby ball. I don't know what the rugby ball is called. That's not why they pay me. But he took it like he's playing rugby. You saw it again on the play that we just watched, where he doesn't follow his lead blockers. To my understanding, that
you don't do that.
You
in
can't
rugby.
Do that in rugby.
You can't block for a guy in rugby. The ball has to be the first thing down the field, so it's opposite for him.
Exactly,
and it showed.
And so, while that instinct to see space, hit space is clearly there with him, you see him. They're losing points because he's not scoring because he runs away from his blockers and toward the other team. And they're little things, and we're nitpicking here for a guy who's got 100 plus yards on just a handful of touches. But those football instincts need to be second nature to him. This isn't rugby anymore. And to put him on the 53-man roster, that means you expect him to make an impact in a real game that really counts in the season. And I don't think he's quite ready to do that yet. I think at least a year or a little bit of time on that practice squad to build those instincts and make that second nature, I think that's going to be very valuable for a guy like him.
Bill said face backup quarterbacks their first two preseason games. It'll be different this Friday night, right? Going against the ones for the Detroit Lions?
It might. We might see Matt Stafford. I don't believe Detroit has played him to this point.
Right.
And Matt Patricia is a disciple of the Bill Belichick, pregame routine. So
yeah.
I don't think we'll find out until, darn near game time. But I think it would be valuable because we already know we know what this defense can do against backup quarterbacks. They, bullied Jacoby Brissett. They made Kyle Allen, look like an undrafted rookie still. And I think you're not seeing – you're I know it's a theme of the show, but we're seeing them do what we expect them to do. Mm-hmm. It would be, I think, comforting for fans, for staff, for the players themselves to go up against a full group, to go up against a full starting group for a couple of series.
It's hard for a team like Carolina to take four all-pros off the field and look like themselves.
Right? It is.
Because those guys are their identity. Keekly, Cam Newton, Christian McCaffrey, and Greg Olsen. I mean, those are four all-pro players, and that changes the entire complexion of their offense and defense when they're off.
It does. Ron Rivera came out and said that, you know, the Bills took advantage of a vanilla game plan, which, I mean, comes off as a little petty, but in all reality, that was not – it was almost like they didn't play the Panthers. If McCaffrey and Cam are not on that offense and Keekly's not quarterback in the defense, you basically didn't play the Panthers.
Right.
But they did succeed and do, once again, what you would expect them to do against a group of reserves. And I think that is better – this might be a glass-half-full approach, but that is way better than the alternative of failing to make an impact against a team without Keekly and Cam.
You mentioned Matt Patricia. Have you guys seen him yet this summer? You see what he's doing? So he had earlier this summer. He had what's the surgery on the back of your leg down here?
Achilles
tendon repaired, and he's got a cart and he rides out the midfield. They've got him set up on a platform, right at the 50-yard line behind the benches. He's got four Gatorade huge jugs in front of him to protect him, and that's where he coaches the game from. The head coach. I saw him. I was watching the Houston game last night. He threw a challenge flag. He had to throw it about 20 yards onto the field. He's not healthy. He rides around in the cart and he sits. I don't know if he'll do it this Friday night, but he could not. He didn't want to get hit, obviously, and he has to sit for the entire game. It's pretty amazing.
It's kind of interesting. interesting trend of coach injuries. I think LaFleur up in Green Bay, didn't he tear his ACL or something like that?
I didn't know that.
I think he had knee surgery. There's some sort of. We'd have to look it up. But
Look for that on Friday. Marcel, this is great. Thank you again for joining
Marcel.
Us. We appreciate it.
I appreciate it anytime, y'all.
There he is, Marcel Louis Jacques. With Murph and Tasker earlier today. So, little football here, and I want to get to some hockey, because we got a Jake Gardner thing that's going on, and Elliot Friedman mentioned the Sabres when talking about Jake Gardner on a radio station in Canada. So whenever that happens, it's a nice excuse for me to talk some hockey. Before that, though, couple of ideas I had for the preseason, and a couple of things I would think either make it more interesting or would help you get rid of it. First, though, there is a report that the NFL is considering. They already had the one proposal about a month ago that they would implement an 18-game regular season schedule but a 16-game player limit, and that two preseason games would be eliminated. I like that idea. It doesn't sound like that's going to get much traction and probably will not happen. But I like where they're going here. They're trying to come up with creative ideas to... You know, because you know they're not going to eliminate the games altogether because of the revenue and blah, 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 blah. But there's other ways that they can do it, that they can keep those games alive while making them mean something. And one way would be to translate those games into or transfer those games into regular season games. Or, like maybe what they're trying to do here, expand the playoffs. Add another team into the playoffs. You add a playoff game. There's your added revenue. There's your added money that you're all looking for. But we don't have to have four preseason games, which is just absolutely absurd. You don't need that many. We had Matt Barkley today talking about how even the players, like they think, you know, coaches generally have stuff figured out by the time they get to the fourth preseason game. Here was Barkley earlier today on that.
I don't think so. I never saw it that way. I saw it as the whole body of work from OTAs and camp. It all added up to whether you had it or not. I think at that point, and especially by the fourth game, I think a lot of decisions have already been made. Not that you can't sway anyone at that point, but for the most part, at that point, coaches and players have seen what you're capable of. And so there's a lot of guys still on the fringe. I think, especially with how much talent that we have, these last two games are going to be big. But from my perspective as a quarterback, every game was important to me, and I never elevated one more than the other.
So if the players don't really think that the third preseason game is different than the fourth, but they also think, like Barkley does there, that most of the decisions are made up, then what are we doing? And a added playoff game obviously would be, I think, a cool idea. So if that happens, cool. Otherwise, if you're going to keep the preseason, can we at least have some fun with it? Can we at least have some creativity along with it? Can we do some stuff that the NBA is, like, at least the NBA hasn't done this yet, but they're trying. They're trying to make things more creative. They're trying to make things more fun with, like, in-season tournaments or whatnot. and what that might be worth, like what you would get out of that tournament. And why don't you do that with the preseason? It's the perfect area to do something like this. 4 preseason games. All right, you want to keep them? Well, guess what? Let's do this. 4 preseason games. If you go 4-1, we're going to give you an extra third-round pick, like a compensatory pick. We're going to give you an extra compensatory pick for going 4-0 in the preseason, or even having a winning record going 3-1. Now, that'd be something to play for, right? It's not a lot to play for, but it's something. It's a reason to root for it, for the result. It's a reason to try. It's a reason for coaches to treat the game like an actual game. Something. It doesn't have to be that, but make it meaningful in some way if it's not, if you're going to have to keep it around. Because the way that the preseason exists right now, like next week, where I think we're already getting a little of this, next week is going to be, oh, why does this exist? Why are we here? Why are we doing this? And I think a lot of people are echoing that sentiment, and it's bleeding into the league. Coaches, Frank Reich, not playing starters in the third preseason game, the all-important third preseason game, the dress rehearsal. No, they're like, we don't need it. Matt Nagy and the Chicago Bears, last year and this year, does not play starters in the preseason. Why? I think he gets, at the end of the day, anything you might gain in terms of reps and all of that is not worth the risk of injury. Like, think about Trubisky. I don't think he's all that great, but you're throwing him out there in a preseason game. How much are the reps worth? If he gets injured, your season is essentially over. All the expectations, all that you're trying to be if you're the Bears this year, I would expect they're trying to make another jump and be like a real Super Bowl contender. You lose your quarterback, that's over. You might still think, oh, I can maybe make the playoffs or I can be competitive or whatever. But you're not going to be what you want to be, which is a Super Bowl contender. And that's at risk because of reps. Really? And more coaches are going to start to understand that, which means more and more starters are going to stop playing in the preseason. So if you already thought the preseason was a drag, if you already thought it was worthless, well, think about it now. If starters played 15 to 20% of the preseason over the last 25 years, I don't know if that number is right, but it just seems like it's right, so I'm just going to throw it out there. 15 to 20%. If that number were to go down to 5% around the league, like if you thought the preseason was already worthless, that's going to get worse because coaches are getting smarter. Coaches are getting more progressive. Coaches are realizing that the risk is not worth the gain in this situation. Maybe, just maybe, if you made it mean a little something, they might take it a little more seriously. Or you just find a way to get rid of the games. That's the logical thing to do. And do you need more than one or two? I don't know if you need two. But that seems to be the number you'd want to go to. And for whatever reason, they just can't find a way to do it. How long does it take for you to understand that you got to do it? The league is not arrived at that conclusion. And it sucks. It sucks that we've got to wait an extra week for real games for these make-believe preseason games that really don't mean anything. I'm mostly talking about the fourth preseason game, but basically the whole preseason game as a whole. All right. A little discussion here on fantasy football and what was discussed earlier on the afternoon show. There was a lot of people calling in about the vetoing system in your league and whether you should allow trades to be vetoed. And I really think it's just a no-brainer. You can't have it. There's just no way. There's no reason to have it. Unless you don't trust who your commissioner is. And if that's the case, then you need a new commissioner. That's your problem, not your system. Because we had a lot of people telling stories today earlier on the air of, oh, I made this trade for this trade, but everyone voted against it because they thought it was unfair. Unfair is not really what the question should ever be if you're thinking about should a trade be vetoed in the fantasy league. It should be, was there foul play? Was there collusion? Was there anything like that? Was there money being exchanged? Was there a split of a purse being exchanged? Those situations warrant a trade being vetoed, but in those situations, you should not need a majority to do it because if that becomes available knowledge, it's a no-brainer. And if it's a no-brainer, you only need one person to make that decision, and that would be your commissioner. So I would say eliminate all vetoes in any fantasy league ever. It's not worth it. It's not worth the headache, and it doesn't even make any sense logically. I've been in plenty of situations where you rip off a player, another person like that, and everyone around the league goes, oh, you got to be kidding me. This guy made that trade. That happens in real sports. And there's no system to say, all right, this trade went, the Sabres traded for Jeff Skinner. And everyone around the league thinks the Hurricanes got gypped on it, got screwed over on it. Or got beat on the trade, I should say. So they're going to say, oh, this trade isn't really that fair, so we're going to veto it. Because what, the Canucks don't like it? You shouldn't be in charge. You shouldn't be able to be in control of your team, or you'll suffer the consequences on your own. If you make a dumb trade, you deserve to suffer the consequences, not get bailed out by other people in your league that don't really have any reason to not want it to happen. So scrap vetoes. It's an easy one. 803-0550 is the phone number. It's the Nightcap with Jody Biasi. I'm going to switch a little to hockey when we come back. Ristolainen, Jake Gardner, the Sabres, what's going on with the blue line? Is anything going to happen? And the status of the RFA market, which is basically the dam that is holding up all of this movement around the league, it seems. It's the Nightcap with Jody Biasi. Thanks for listening here on WGR.
I think there's, you know, I mean, I've heard the rumors that he's waiting for a team to make a move. I do think there's some interest in him. I think Arizona's had interest in him. And I do wonder about Buffalo. Like, if they do make the Ristolainen move, I wonder if that's a possibility. I just don't know if it's going to be as big as he hoped for it to be.
There is Elliot Friedman of Sportsnet talking to Jake Gardner, UFA defenseman, who is still on the market. There was a rumor that he mentioned it there on Gardner a little while ago in the offseason that basically said that he's got a wink-wink deal with a team and he's waiting for them to clear cap space and or waiting for other stuff to happen before he can officially sign. And that could be Buffalo. That could be, because we know that, I think we pretty much know that they are trying to trade Ristolainen and or he's on the market for sure. And if that happens, that would further, like if that happens, if Ristolainen goes out the door and Gardner comes in. Now, I don't love the player. I like the player. And at this point in the offseason, I'd have to think he's not getting the money that he was originally hoping to get. Otherwise, he would have signed already. And if that's the case, then I might like the value a little better than I thought. If I had to pay $6.5-7 million for this guy, I don't think I'm on board. But, you know, a little less. Like, if I can get him at five, I'm okay with that. I think he's about that level of good. He's more of the puck mover than Ristolainen is. He's more modern than Ristolainen is in terms of his style of defense. And I think he would fit into what the Sabres have been trying to do this offseason, which is make over their blue line in that direction. He would kind of complete that, almost. Like, you would need, I think, still to know that Bogosian and Scandella and those guys that are eating up big cap numbers are not here at the beginning of the year. But suddenly, if you can pull that off and your blue line's looking like Dahlin and Colin Miller and Montour and Gardner and Joki Haru and Pilot, like, now that is a full blue line filled with good passing defensemen. And they have had none of that, almost none of that, for the last 10 years. It's been part of the reason they have the longest playoff drought in the league. And Gardner, while, like I said, I don't love the player, he is certainly somewhat good, and I think he would certainly contribute to what the Sabres are trying to accomplish this offseason. So I like the idea, and I like the idea a lot. Now, that's dependent on a Ristolainen trade getting done. And the report on Marner yesterday was that he's talking with a team in Switzerland. He might go to Leafs camp without a contract, but it doesn't sound like they're any closer on a contract. This is trending in the direction of the Willie Nylander situation last year, where he was in a contract negotiation all offseason with the Leafs. Season starts, he's not there, and he sits out until December. What happened last year also, Nylander got a big contract, and because he signed it in December, the Leafs had to suffer a $10 million cap hit for last year. This year, They can't do that same thing. They can't. Marner can't go down the same path Nylander did, because if they have to do a contract like that somewhere in the middle of the season and he signs there, I just don't know if they can make that cap work. I don't know if they can make the cap work to begin with. So maybe Toronto's got to do some stuff. Tampa's got to do some stuff. Calgary's got to do some stuff. We know Winnipeg's got to do some stuff, and that's the team we talk about with Ristolainen the most. The market does not set up for a Ristolainen trade right now. That should be obvious because nothing's happened. Unless Edmonton comes flying out of nowhere and offers you Nugent Hopkins, which I don't think that's on the table, or else that would have been done already. Should have been done already. So, what to expect? I'll be honest, if nothing else happens on the RFA market, until that happens, I would be stunned if you get a Ristolainen trade. The market's got to move in some way. And where is that going to come? Someone's got to deviate from the current path. Someone's got to sign before Marner does. He can't be the domino that knocks everything else over. One of the other dominoes behind him is going to have to fall first. That could be Laine. That could be Connor. That could be Matthew Tkachuk. I think maybe Winnipeg would be the team that does cave first. Because their team, they're good, but how good are they? They got a young core of players that is led, like their two best young players are the two that they need to sign, Laine and Connor. Two of their best players. I like Scheifele more than both of them, actually. But they're right there. What does that team look like if those two are not on the ice? They're still a good team, but that might hold them back from being a truly great team. That might be the team that has the most to lose by not having their RFAs go to the market. Toronto, they cannot have Marner. They're still a playoff team. Tampa, they cannot have Point. They're still a playoff team. Maybe, just maybe, Winnipeg is that team that cracks and says, all right, we're not waiting for Marner. Maybe they wouldn't be the ones that cracks. Maybe it'd be the players like Laine and Connor. They say, all right, we're not waiting anymore. We're signing. I'm not going to miss any part of the season. Let's get it done. And then maybe that could be what bursts the dam and everything happens. And Marner's just kind of off on his own to the side. And we're waiting for that to happen. And maybe it never ultimately does. So that's my little spiel on the Ristolainen status report and where we stand with that. The Gardner idea, like Elliot Friedman says there, I would think the Sabres would be interested in that. I wouldn't be surprised if they are the team that has a wink-wink deal with Jake Gardner. 803-0550 is the phone number. If you got any thoughts on that, we're gonna hear some powerful stuff after the break, though. Steve Seftel, former pro hockey player, he wrote a book kind of on his struggles with mental health, and he joined Chopin the Bulldog earlier today. It was a really good interview. We're gonna play some of that back after the break. It's the Nightcap with Joe DiBiase. Thanks for listening here on WGR. All right, last call on the Nightcap. Joe DiBiase here on WGR. We're going to spend last call playing back something, a really good interview, I thought, from earlier today on the station. If you're not familiar with Steve Seftel, he wrote a book that you can find on Amazon. You can find it on our Twitter at WGR550.com. And, it's about, really, he's talking about his mental health and some of the struggles that a lot of players go through that's kind of not talked about a whole lot. Like Dan Carcillo comes to mind for this. If you follow him on social media, he's been a big proponent of kind of bringing light to mental illness in hockey like this. And, Steve Montador obviously passed away a few years back. That's part of this whole conversation, the players that we've lost over the years. And Steve Seftel, I thought, here it is. I'll just play it right here. He was really good earlier today right here with Chopin the Bulldog.
We're pleased to have Steve Seftel on the West Shore Hotline. Steve is a former professional hockey player who has written a book about hockey and more called Shattered Ice. Steve, Mike, and Chris here. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you as well. It's my pleasure to be a guest on your show. I'm really looking forward to it.
Thank you. So your book is about your career and also mental illness and the struggles within your career and life. Elaborate, if you would, Steve. Tell us your story.
Well, like, it's important to know, Mike, that I wasn't diagnosed with a mental illness until 2 years ago when I had a complete, what I would call, mental breakdown, and was in a condition where I couldn't get out of bed, and I didn't want to get out of bed, and I became physically ill from the mental illness. But as far as my hockey career goes, the first time I was aware of this, I was about age 16. It was the first time I had my first panic attack. And that one happened when I was in Czechoslovakia playing my midget Kitchener green shirts on a trip we had over there, and I was stuck in an elevator. That was the first time I was aware of it. And I played 3 years in the Ontario Hockey League for the then Kingston Canadiens. Suffered somewhat through those years, but I didn't really understand it because it was not, mental health wasn't something we talked about. And those feelings followed me into my pro career, drafted by the Washington Capitals second round, 40th overall in 1986. And then I did play for the Capitals in the 90-91 season, but I was in the organization for 7 years, and I left about 1993.
Do you feel like you left a lot on the table with your career because of the mental condition you were in during, you know, all that time? I mean, you obviously achieved enough to be the 40th pick in the draft. It's not like you were under the radar or anything, but do you feel like it really held you back? Do you think your career would have been different if you had received some kind of assistance or treatment in those years, Steve?
I do, and it's unfortunate that back then we didn't talk about it. I mean, the mentality then was be a warrior. You pay the price. You do all the things you have to do to be a hockey player. And it's basically whatever it takes, and talking about how you felt mentally was not part of that playbook. And it was so when things started to spiral for me out of control was really in early of 1992, after the Capitals training camp, and I was coming back from my second ACL tear, and that was really a devastating blow. And we never, something else we don't take into consideration is the trauma players suffer from injuries that, but it was, again, not part of the mentality or the makeup of the time, and it's just you dealt with those things on your own internally. And as a result, I think it does have a cumulative effect and definitely affected me leaving quicker than maybe I should have.
Did you ever – how close did you ever get to talking to someone, confiding in someone, be it a teammate, a trainer, a coach, a family member, whatever, like during this whole time, I would say from the time it first cropped up, you said, while you were playing juniors in Czechoslovakia, all the way through to your pro career. Did you ever get right to the edge of actually talking to someone about, hey, something isn't right with me, I want to talk about it?
I did not, and I'll be honest with you, it was 2 years ago. It was the first time I ever discussed it openly with anyone other than my wife, but back in those days, I didn't discuss it at all and never even thought about it. But 2 years ago, I was asked to watch Michael Landsberg, and he has some really good videos about mental illness. And that is truthfully the first time I ever heard anyone openly discuss it. And it actually opened the gate for me to starting to go down the road where I would talk about it with family and friends.
With Steve Seftel, author of the book Shattered Ice, former professional hockey player. So I think I would expect, Steve, most players from your playing days to say the same thing about how players were not open about like their feelings, to put it that way. What I don't know is, I'll go further. I think I know I would also expect to hear my wife and my close friends say, no, it's totally okay. You should. You know, I think people around me would be like that, supportive and open and encouraging like that. What I don't know is what it would be like in sports right now or in hockey right now. Bulldog might, because his son is playing, you know, close to playing at the junior level with the Greyhounds and made that team and now is going to be playing it in high school. And, where do you think, if you know, like, as you've talked to people, Steve, you must know a lot of people in the game still. Doug McLean wrote the foreword for this book even. How far have we come?
I think I compare it to turning an ocean liner around. So it takes a long time to turn that ship around, and I think it's just begun. So we're slowly changing the direction of the ship. There's still a lot of work to do. I think from the Ontario Hockey League, there is a preparation course or an awareness, mental health awareness course that the players are taking now at training camp. But there's still a lot of work to do, without question. And we can tie this into concussions as well. dealing with the head.
Yeah.
Whether it's concussions, mental illness, it's the brain and the head has been ignored for far too long, and it's starting to change, but there's still a long way to go.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of there's a lot of former players that have been, I think, pretty vocal. Daniel Carcillo comes to mind. I don't know if you're familiar with the work he's done. A lot of it's just on Twitter, raising awareness about head injuries. And I'm thinking about even national corporate initiatives like Bell Let's Talk, I think is something that happens once a year within in the hockey community. But at least on Twitter, it's like everybody I follow that's affiliated with hockey in any way is in on Let's Talk about mental health. So I think there is I feel like it's earnest and well-meaning, like how far it's getting in these early stages, like you're referring to this ocean liner. I mean, I can't say, but I think an effort's being made.
I would agree with that, and I think Bell Let's Talk is also a great initiative. And I hope at one point we get to this a day where it's not just a one-day event in the course of the calendar year, that it's something the players are comfortable talking about whenever they need the support or the help from their coaches and the teams, and that it's just not something we kind of promote once a year. But, I mean, it's a starting point, which is a good thing. And
right.
I know from my own situation, my year, something that hit me hard was Joe Murphy was the first overall pick of my draft year by the Detroit Red Wings.
Yeah.
I know he's suffering. Well, I shouldn't say I know he's going through some of his own personal struggles, and, you know, it just shows you that there's a lot of high-functioning people who still suffer from mental illness.
Yeah. So, yeah, if people aren't familiar with Murphy's story, he's been homeless. A lot of former teammates and players tried to reach out and help him, and I think did for a while. But then he walked away from that, and he's had numerous concussions in his career, and I think he's a real – he might be like the headliner story for this sort of conversation right now, because first overall pick, very good career, and it, you know, his personal life once he stopped playing hockey just unraveled, and he stopped playing hockey in part because of the number of head injuries he had.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, you look at Joe, he had a number of concussions, but something else we have to look at, as you said, that's a severe case, but there's also people out there struggling who sometimes they're just in a rough patch and they're going through some depression and anxiety, and they think there's no alternative and no way out. And we have to, you know, we got to look at everybody and just give the opportunity to people to seek out help and listen to them when they need someone to talk to.
Yeah. How, when you were coming up in juniors and it started to look like maybe this was something you could really take to the max, like, you know, you're going to get drafted, you could make the league. Did that create a pressure internally that was hard to manage? Like, is that a part of this story? Because Mike referenced my son. I think about that with him all the time, because the farther you go, the higher the stakes get, right? And it's set up. It's almost like all I got to do now is land the plane. Right? Like, you've got this next spot set up for you, and then this next spot, and it's all going well. Just don't screw it up. And I think that creates a lot of pressure.
I agree. You're right. So I got drafted in June of 1986, went to the Capitals training camp in that September, played quite well. I got in two exhibition games. As a matter of fact, I have a chapter in my book called Bork's Corner. My first exhibition game was against the Boston Bruins at the Capitol Center. And Ray Bork was in the lineup, so that was an amazing thrill for me. But right after that camp, as you were saying, the stakes getting higher, I signed a contract with the Capitals after returning to Kingston. And that's when I felt things did start to ramp up, and I did feel more internal pressure to succeed game in and game out, that I was always auditioning. And as you said, you just got to land the plane, and you are on this track, and the pressure definitely built, and sometimes it's a self-inflicted pressure cooker, but it is. There's no outlets at the time, and you go down that road, and it can be.
We still have you, Steve? You might have dropped off.
Yeah, we lost him there, I think. Yeah.
I was about to tell him that I think I saw him play.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, with Miners? Baltimore.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned to Rob Ray a number of times that Rob scored an overtime goal for Rochester when I was going to their games in my college years, and he remembers it. And Barry Trotz was the Baltimore coach, and Steve would have been on that team. A lot of his book toward the end is give him back. Okay. Steve, I was just saying, I think I saw you play for Baltimore.
In Rochester?
Yes, yes. Because it came back to me when you were writing about Trotz toward the end and having some difficulty with him. And he was the coach of that Baltimore team. I remembered that. And we've talked to Rob Ray about an overtime goal he scored against Baltimore in the playoffs. Is that a memory you have?
Yes, it is. That was a playoff game. I think that year Doug McClain was our coach. That was a dagger in that series, that overtime goal by Rob Ray.
Yeah, that's what I remember.
Wow, Rob Ray with a dagger. I can't wait to talk to him about that.
He doesn't bring it up every time he sees you. But how about Trotz? Like, what I got from your book was that, you know, you might have looked up to him and then you struggled in terms of communication with him eventually.
Well, when I first was drafted, Barry Trotz was a scout with the Capitals organization. And then he was promoted to assistant coach in Baltimore under Rob Laird. And then Mr. Poile fired Rob Laird and Barry assumed the head coaching job. That was his first head coaching opportunity with the Baltimore Skipjacks. So the relationship changed because I knew him as a scout and then an assistant coach. You know, often assistant coaches are the one you bounce things off as a player. And now he was the boss. And to approach him as the boss was a little more challenging. And, mm-hmm. But I was going through my own personal struggles at the time. And like we talked about, I didn't know how to ask for help. And I probably didn't go about it the best way. A chapter in my book, I talk about how I didn't go to a golf
event.
Skipped
a golf tournament.
Of all things not to go to, I skipped a golf event.
Right.
And he was very upset with me. And at least that started some dialogue. I think the reason I skipped that event is I just wanted to talk to somebody in the organization about the way my career was headed. And we did clear the air that way. But I certainly at the time, we talked about my playing, but we did not talk about what I was feeling inside mentally. So I still buried that, and it came back to bite me in the end.
So how are things now? Like, you've written the book. How is it being received? And like, since you've talked to, you mentioned you for a long time didn't talk to anyone but your wife, but I assume you've talked to your family about it now, and like, it's all out there. How are you feeling with all of that, you know, being so public now?
It was very challenging at first. I went to see Doug McClain in March. He was one of the first people I told outside of immediate family and close friends. And it was difficult to get the words out. I was sputtering and stumbling over trying to tell him I had a mental illness. And he was surprised. But he certainly said, he said to me, I wish I could have helped you. But I said, you can't, because I would have never told you at that back in those days. But and I asked him to write the foreword. And since then, it has just been a continuous flow of reconnecting with the players I've pushed away for the last two decades, including guys like, you know, another former Rochester American, Scott Metcalf, who I played junior with in Kingston, and Scott Pearson, who's an ex-Saber in Toronto Maple Leaf. He played with me in Kingston as well. He was the best man at my wedding. And Doug McClain, Rob Laird, my former coach. Jack Button drafted me back in the day. He's no longer with us, but his sons, Craig Button and Todd Button, reached out, and they've read the book as well. Recently, Kenny Albert reached out to me. He was the play-by-play man with the Skipjacks when I was in there for my last couple of years. So it's been incredible to have all these the hockey family coming back to me, as I really thought they had disowned me, but they didn't. It was just me convinced my brain telling me lies.
Well, Steve, it's been a pleasure getting to know you here. You're a good writer, and it's a good story. And I think it's also something that we really, if it isn't self-evident, it would be, of course, relatable and interesting to players who played sports and then left sports, because that in and of itself is tumultuous and challenging for a lot of guys, you know, I've heard and read. So I think people might relate to that too, if that's their story. Good luck. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. And I'm a huge Bills fan, which And I was hoping, Mike, you would say, do you have any questions for us? Because that's your famous line.
Yes, well, please ask if you do. I should have said that.
Yes, because I always look forward to that when you ask your guests. So my question was going to be, do you think the Bills are a playoff team?
Well, it's possible. I mean, they're in the middle, and all the teams in the middle have a chance. I'm not assuming they are. I'm not expecting them to be, but, you know, they certainly are not. They're not Miami or something where you'd think that's almost definitely not happening.
Yeah, the Patriots make it particularly challenging. Steve, you know how often we talk about that if you listen to the show on any kind of basis as a Bills fan. Like, you got to win the division or you got to battle the vast middle class of the entire conference for two spots. And, I mean, that is a tough way to live.
Yes, I know. I've listened to you guys talk about Mr. Brady and Mr. Belichick for many years. Yes, it is very challenging being in that division.
Yeah. They're the only two people who've been working together longer than we have. Brady and Belichick. Yeah. Little known fact. All right.
Thank you for writing this book, really. The content, I think, is important, and it's very well done. So congratulations to you for doing it.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on. It's been a real thrill for me.
All right. I thought that was a great interview there. Steve Septel, I hope you enjoyed it. You can check out all of our stuff from throughout the day at WGR550.com and the radio.com app. But that's going to do it for me tonight. So thank you, everybody, for listening. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 7. It'll be my last show of the week because, of course, Friday will be Bills at Lions. So we'll have a little preview of the preseason matchup tomorrow night. Running back, I didn't get into that today. Gore and McCoy are going to play. We'll talk a little bit about that, as well as wide receiver and some of the other positions we'll be looking for in the Bills' third preseason game. But for those of you that are going to be stayed tuned, NASCAR fans especially, you'll want to stick around because Pit Reporters is on the way next. This has been the Nightcap with Joe DiBiase here on WGR.